Sounded like it. Somebody got on her phone, and every time it goes off, I jump up and get the doorbell, and then... All right, good morning. It's great to see everybody come out to study the Bible and worship with us today. We have some visitors. We're happy that you're here, of course, and excited about the new quarter that begins today here at Eastside. All of the classes are progressing and starting something new today, and it's an exciting day for us, of course. We're starting the book of Romans in this class. We'll take that through the quarter. Will is handing out a bit of a syllabus that will help at least you to know what we're studying on which days, and I'll try to stay pretty close to that as we go through. Occasionally, as you know, if you've been in my classes, I do get behind once in a while, but we'll try to stay pretty well abreast of what the syllabus says. I would also encourage you to notice at the bottom of that a lot of the sort of outline for the study and some of the content of this study, I need to credit to Brother Robert Harkrider and his book on Romans, workbook on Romans. And it's really a little bit expensive for us to just, you know, buy a book for everybody in the class. A lot of times those don't even get used. But if you are interested in that, having one of those booklets, they're available at CEI. Scott Richardson publishes them, and he has his website, Spiritual Service Supply. You could get one through either place. They're less than $10, I think. So if you're interested in that and want something to kind of study along at home, you're certainly welcome to do that. It's, as I said, what I use in a lot of my classes. Brother Harkrider's done a really good job of laying out the outlines of books and sort of how to chop them up into. I don't always use everything he says, but I do sort of use his overall organization of the material. So I find that helpful. But we are starting Romans, and we're going to call this Salvation by the Gospel through Obedience to the Faith, and we'll see why that title for this study, or subtitle I should say, I think is appropriate as we go through. Let's just introduce the book for a little bit this morning, and we'll study through the first 17 verses if we can together. Just a little bit of background. We don't have time to look at a lot of things to the background of Romans that we might like. You might think about, you know, what we could say about the city itself, the people that were there, as far as the Christians that were there, some of the things that they were facing. I'm not going to take the time to go through all of that because, frankly, we don't have the time. But there's some interesting secular history that might be studied about Rome and its significance in the spread of Christianity. But let's just start this morning by saying that here's an epistle that's written by Paul to the saints in Rome. It's written from Corinth, almost certainly, near the end of Paul's third journey, probably 57 to 58 AD. The reason that we can say that with some certainty is he mentions some of the people that are with him, where he sends greetings to folks in Rome. The connection of all of that, we'll see all of that when we get to Romans 16. Good number of names are mentioned. There's some other things that are mentioned in the book of Romans that just really indicate he's very likely in Corinth, and this would be because of some past history that he mentions, 57 to 58 AD, pretty certain about that. Paul had not yet at this time, amazingly, he had not yet visited Rome. He certainly wished to do so. He knew many of the saints that are there, as I mentioned. He mentions a number of them in Romans chapter 16. He'd run across them, some of them when he was in Corinth the first time, some of them in other places. But I want to go read Romans 15, starting in verse 22. And he mentions a couple of times in the book of Romans that he wants to visit them. And again, here in Romans 15, 22, "For this reason, I also have been much hindered from coming to you. But now, no longer having a place in these parts and having a great desire these many years to come to you." So for a long time, he's wanted to go to Rome. He says, "Whenever I journey to Spain, I shall come to you, for I hope to see you on my journey and be helped on my way there by you, if first I may enjoy your company for a while. But now I go to Jerusalem to minister to the saints. It pleased those from Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints who are in Jerusalem." So that really gives us the time frame that Paul is writing. He is on this third missionary journey. You remember the story. He's getting together a collection from the churches to go down to deliver to the saints in Jerusalem. He mentions this contribution in 1 Corinthians 16 and again in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. So we have a really good concept of where this fits into the time frame of Paul's work especially. But we see that, he hasn't been to Rome. He does know these people. He's pretty aware of some of the issues that they're facing. But Romans isn't really a book about, here's what you're facing in the near term in Rome. It has to do with broader themes than that, as we'll see as we go along. The gospel probably was preached in Rome by some who were present on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2. You remember when the apostles, the Holy Spirit came on them, they began to speak with other tongues and preach the gospel. And there were people from all over the world there, Jews who'd come to Jerusalem for that feast of Pentecost. And among them, it says in Acts chapter 2 and verse 10, there were visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes. That is pretty critical as well. So there on the day of Pentecost, you had not residents of Jerusalem, but visitors from Rome, it specifically says, who were both Jews and also proselytes. So some who were already Greeks who had converted over to Judaism, in essence. And the supposition, I think it's a good one, very likely some of them are going to go back to Rome since they're only visiting in Jerusalem, and that's likely where the church began in Rome. So the saved in Rome include both Jews and Gentiles. You could tell that not only from the observation we just made from Acts 2, but in the book of Romans itself, you see it a couple of places. Romans chapter 1 and verse 13. I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that I've often planned to come to you, but was hindered until now, that I might have some fruit among you also, just as among the other Gentiles. So Paul is anticipating, when he gets to Rome, having the opportunity to share the truth with Gentiles. But you go over to chapter 11 of the book of Romans. There are several other places we can point this out in Romans, but chapter 11 and verse 13, I speak to you Gentiles inasmuch as I also am an apostle to the Gentiles. I magnify my ministry. So again, speaking to Gentiles. But in chapter 7 and verse 1, do you not know, brethren, for I speak to those that know the law. Obviously, they're speaking to Jews, okay, directly. So he addresses Jewish Christians. He addresses Gentile Christians. There seems to be a pretty even mix of the two that are being addressed in this epistle, in this great epistle. When you think about the book of Romans, I think nearly every commentary I looked at, scholar that I've looked at, teacher that I've sat at the feet of over the years, would almost universally agree that Romans 1, 16, and 17 is the core passage, the theme passage of the book of Romans. I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also for the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. So there's the grand theme, I believe, of this epistle to the Romans. And I'm going to try to leave some time at the end of the class period today to look at that in somewhat more detail. But for now, let's look at this outline. As all of you know, I like to, in teaching any book of the Bible, outline it. In fact, I would really recommend to you that you make that a part of your personal study. If you're trying to get a grasp on what's in a particular book of the Bible, read through it multiple times and then try to outline it for yourself. Don't look at somebody else's outline. Try to outline it for yourself. What's a major point? What are the, how does it flow from one thing to another? Helps you get a really good grasp of the whole idea of a book. So here is an outline that I think really helps us. Simple three major points. The first eight chapters are doctrinal, how the gospel saves the sinner. And I might say that this is the unique theme of the book of Romans. The gospel is the power of God to salvation. And so you have this introduction of the importance of the gospel. Then you have everybody needs the gospel because All have sinned. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So we all need salvation. The gospel saves us by grace through faith, from chapter 4 and 5. And then faith requires and acquires a changed life. It'll change you when you're saved by the gospel. And that aspect of it is noted in chapter 6, 7, and 8. I think what's unique about the epistle of Romans is these first eight chapters, where the inspired writer Paul lays out for us here in a way that is not found in any other New Testament book, this whole rationale for the gospel, that, you know, just logically laid out one thing right after another in a beautiful and really thorough way that we'll be able to examine. I think keeping that in your head as you go through Romans is very helpful. A lot of people get, you know, you seem to be talking about one thing here, and maybe you're talking about something else here, but that's not really how Romans is. Romans is flowing from one logical thought into another. It's almost like Paul presents this, then answers the question that, you know, that might raise, and then answers another question that that might raise, and just flows straight through in a really logical, reasonable sequence. So these first eight chapters, I think, are critical. Then you have something that's unique to Romans as well, but you don't really find it developed very much in any other book of the Bible, but maybe not as relevant to us today, because it has to do with how the gospel relates to physical Israel. And there's some things in there that are for us, but has to do with the explanation of what's God doing here. I thought the nation of Israel what were his promised people, and how does the gospel relate to their salvation? And so you have three chapters dealing with that. And then the last portion of the book, really from chapters 12, 13, 14, and 15, here's this: okay, if you're saved by the gospel, how does that change your life? What's the practical implication of that as you're living day by day? And there are a lot of really practical things at the end of the book. And then you have this final concluding chapter that just has a lot of exhortations and salutations, greetings to people that Paul knew in Rome and elsewhere. So that's just sort of a really quick overview of what Romans is going to be for us, and hopefully we'll come to understand that more and more as we go along. Let's start out then going back to Romans chapter 1 and verse 1. Paul, a bondservant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, separated to the gospel of God. He identifies himself as a servant of Jesus Christ. He identifies himself that way multiple times. In Titus chapter 1 and verse 1, in Galatians chapter 1 and verse 10, there he says, if I am striving to please men, if I still please men, I would not be a servant of Christ. So being a servant of Christ means that you're pleasing Christ. You live to please Christ. And he makes that assertion right off the bat. And the second assertion that he makes is that he's called to be an apostle. An apostle is one who is sent, obviously. In the book of Acts, Paul records for us three times Jesus' appearance to him on the road to Damascus. I say Paul records, Luke does. But that record of Jesus appearing to him on the road to Damascus occurs three times. In the Acts 26 record of that, Jesus tells him, I've appeared to you, this is Acts 26 and verse 16, to make you a minister and a witness. The thing is that the apostles were witnesses. And although I know our Congress is confused about this, a witness actually has to have seen something in order to testify about it. You have to have experienced it to testify about it. So Paul is a witness to the, and so Jesus appeared to him so Paul could say, I saw Jesus. You know, he couldn't say that if Jesus hadn't appeared to him. It was to open their eyes to turn them again. Well, he says, I will deliver you from the Jewish people, verses verse 17, as well as from the Gentiles to whom I now send you. Greek word is apostolo, the verb. I now send you. When you apostolo somebody, you make them an apostolos. You make them an apostle. Okay, so that's what Jesus does there. And the purpose was to turn them from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins. So he is specifically sent by the Lord. He separated, the end of verse 1 says, to the gospel of God. Again, the gospel is really the theme of this book. So Paul is one sent, separated for the purpose of sharing the gospel. And again, you see that in the commission that's given him in Acts chapter 26. So the good news of the gospel, he wants to talk about to us now in just really setting out the theme for the book, chapter 1 and verse 2 of Romans. Talking about the gospel of God, which he promised, God promised the gospel. That's the point of that. God promised the gospel through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures concerning his Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord, who was born of the seed of David according to the flesh and declared to be the Son of God with power according to the Spirit of holiness by the resurrection from the dead. So the gospel was something that was foretold and promised by the prophets. Anybody who's been a part of our class in here for the last quarter, I hope that you would have no doubt about that reality, that the gospel was promised before. The Messiah coming, the Messiah saving his people, the Messiah saving the Gentiles, the coming kingdom, how it would bring us to God, all of that. We saw prophecy after prophecy in the books of the minor prophets that we've just studied, and there could be many more that we could mention. Peter talks about this. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 10, this salvation the prophets have inquired and searched carefully, who prophesied of the grace that would come to you. The Old Testament prophets were talking about the grace that would come to us. So Paul says this is that gospel. It was promised before through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures. And we've been, just the last quarter, been able to read some of those very prophecies that were given, promised. And the gospel is concerning the Christ who is coming, came in Paul's time, but was to come from the seed of David. Again, this is a theme that we looked at repeatedly in the previous quarter, studying some of the prophets. 2 Samuel 7, what did God promise David? Of the fruit of his body, he'd raise up a son to sit on his throne forever, right? So there's the promise of the coming king that is reiterated multiple times in the Old Testament prophets. Isaiah chapter 9, for instance, for unto us a son is born, unto us a child is given, it says, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, in order to establish it with judgment and justice from this time forward and forever, the zeal of the Lord will accomplish it. Just one prophecy of so many that you have, talking about the seed of David that's going to sit on that throne and bring peace and salvation to those who believe in the Son. So that's what Paul's talking about. Do you get it? Paul's talking about this thing, this wonderful purpose of God that has been foretold by the prophets that people have been looking forward to, and he's talking about the coming Christ then who brought it all to happen. He was declared to be the Son of God, not, by the way, so much at his physical birth. I know we're coming into a season of the year where everybody wants to think about the physical birth of Christ. And there are facts about that that demonstrate him to be the Son of God. But that's not what really shows him to be the Son of God. Y'all realize that? When the Old Testament talks about the fact that here is God's Son, this day I have begotten you, you know, he's not talking about his physical birth. He's talking about his resurrection from the dead. The reason we know that is something that's said in Acts 13 and verse 32. Apostle Paul says, "We declare to you glad tidings." Anybody want to tell me what another word for glad tidings is? Good news, the gospel. What's Paul talking about? The gospel, the good news. And so Paul, preaching in Antioch, says, "We declare to you the gospel, the good news, the glad tidings, that promise which was made to the fathers." So he's using the same language here he's using in writing to the Romans. It was promised to the fathers. God has fulfilled this for us, their children, in that he has raised up Jesus, as it is written in the second Psalm, "You are my son. This day I have begotten you." What identifies Jesus as the son? The resurrection. And that's the point. Go back to Romans. That's what he says. He was declared to be the Son of God. I just read the verse. Verse 4. Declared to be the Son of God with power according to the Spirit of holiness. How? By the resurrection from the dead. There it is. There's the proof that Jesus is the Son of God. Y'all have questions or anything on this, or something you want to throw out? All right. Powerful beginning to this great book. I hope you're appreciating that. Paul, he has a purpose in his apostleship, and he intends to fulfill it. He's fulfilling it in part in this book. So go back to Romans 1, look at verse 5. "Through him," that is, through Christ, "we have received grace and apostleship for obedience to the faith among all nations for his name." That phrase right there is... don't miss it. The purpose of the gospel is to bring obedience to the faith. Don't let anybody tell you that obedience is not critical to the gospel. Without human obedience, the gospel does not save. Paul says that he uses the same phrase at the very end of the book of Romans. He uses it here. The gospel is preached for obedience to the faith among all nations for his name's sake. There are things to be obeyed in order to be saved by the gospel. And anybody that reads the book of Romans or teaches the book of Romans who says that there's nothing to do to be saved is just absolutely blown away what Paul said. Okay? It's all for obedience to the faith among all the nations. That doesn't mean we earn salvation. It does not mean we deserve salvation. Paul will be at pains in Romans to explain that to us. But it does mean that we must believe and obey. Obedience to the faith among all nations, among whom you're also the called of Jesus. So Paul had received this apostleship despite being the chief of sinners, you might remember, through an extraordinary disposition of grace. He says, "We have received grace and apostleship." What did he say about himself in 1 Timothy chapter 1? He's the chief of sinners, yet God's rich in mercy and called him, nonetheless, to preach the gospel. The Romans were among those of all nations who'd been called by the gospel to the obedience of the faith. They've been called by the gospel to the obedience of the faith. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, in verses 13 and 14. I think you see that. Called by the gospel. So, as a result of that, these are beloved saints. You're called, you're the called of Jesus Christ. Verse 7, "To all who are in Rome, beloved of God, called to be saints. So he's writing to all the saints in Rome. So the book of Romans, by the way, and we'll see this more clearly a bit later, it's not written to a specific church. Rome had was an expansive city, probably over a million people in Paul's day, maybe the largest city on earth at the time. A lot of people coming in and out, but the point is there were multiple churches in Rome, and we can even see that. There was a church that met in the home of Aquila and Priscilla, for instance, that's mentioned in Romans chapter 16. So, but he's writing to all of the saints in Rome. This would have included a number of local churches that would have been there. But they're called to, they were called to be saints, and so that's what they are. What's a saint, by the way? Does that mean? One who's been set apart, a holy person. The word saint connected really closely in the original language to the word holy and also to the word sanctified. All those words come out of the same Greek word. Holy, saint, sanctified, all come out of the same word. So we need to think of those together when we see the word saints. All right. Paul greets them with grace and peace. And I mention this a lot when we're talking about Paul's writings. It's a really common greeting that he uses. It's a greeting indicative of both their ethnic diversity and the equality of their spiritual blessings. The reason it indicates ethnic diversity is because grace was a Greek greeting, still is today. In Greece, if you walk down the street, people don't say hi, they say kare, and it's the Greek word for grace. And if you walk down the streets of Jerusalem, people don't say hi, what do they say? Shalom, which is the Hebrew word for peace, grace and peace. Okay, so it's indicative of ethnic diversity, but also of the unity of blessings that all of those receiving this would have received, both grace and peace. They all had received that in a spiritual sense. Paul's great about taking common words and common experiences and spiritualizing them. Even as we saw in the prophecy of Zechariah, it would be, everything would be holy in people's lives, even the common things. So, really good introduction, I think, there to what Paul's saying to us. He had tremendous passion for these people. He prayed for them. Let's look in verse 8. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I make mention of you always in my prayers, making request if by some means now at last I may find a way in the will of God to come to you. For I long to see you that I may impart to you some spiritual gift, so that you may be established, that is, that I may be encouraged together with you by the mutual faith both of you and me. Now I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that I often planned to come to you, but was hindered until now, but that I might have some fruit among you also, just as among the other Gentiles. I'm a debtor both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to wise and to unwise. So as much as in me, I am ready to preach the gospel to you who are in Rome also. Paul mentions repeatedly in this text the gospel, the gospel, the gospel. It's going to be the focus of everything. He mentions it twice in that paragraph that I just read. He thanks God for their exemplary faith, that he hadn't been to Rome, but he'd heard of their faith. People all over the world were hearing about the faith of these people in Rome. And in the New Testament age, it was an extraordinary faith. He prays for them without ceasing. He gives thanks for them. Preached about this last Sunday morning, the thanksgiving for the faith that they had, for the impact that their lives were having. He wants to impart some spiritual gift so that they may be established. He wants to be encouraged to be with them by their faith, their mutual faith, and all of that. And then he had often planned to come to them, we mentioned this already, but had been hindered. He wanted to go to other places too, but had been hindered. Hindered at times by the plans of God. You might remember on his second journey, Paul wanted to go here and there and everywhere when he got to Troas. Where'd God want him to go? To Macedonia, right? So sometimes, you know, Paul had plans, and as a human being, he'd like to do this and that, but God said, no, here's what we're doing. And then other times, there's no doubt that he was hindered by the devil from doing what God wanted or what he wanted to do. And so that was maybe the case here, was certainly the case with the problem in Thessalonica where persecution had arisen. But he desired, this is interesting, he desired some fruit among them. I desire some fruit. Is Paul, what's the deal there? Is he like, it's all about me. You know, I'm going to get some fruit. Is that what he's saying? No. God gives the increase. Any fruit that we have brings glory to God. All right. He's the vine, we're the branches, we bear fruit. It doesn't bring glory to us, it brings glory to him. And that's what Paul wants. He wants more fruit all the time. He's working to produce fruit for the glory of God. That's not a bad thing. Paul saw himself indebted, and we need to see ourselves this way as well. I like verses 14 and 15 a lot. I'm a debtor both to Greeks and to barbarians, to the wise and the unwise. Paul saw himself indebted to preach the gospel to everybody. Didn't matter the ethnicity or the intellect. In the Greco-Roman world, especially among the Greeks, who and the Romans had it sort of inherited their world, but a Greek was an educated and cultured person. A barbarian was anybody who wasn't Greek, who didn't have the Greek education and culture. So you're looking at, you know, huge prejudicial, racial, ethnic differences when you use that kind of language. Both barbarian and Greek. It didn't matter to Paul. You know, and think about our world today. We're surrounded by people of all different, you know, ethnicities, educational levels, degrees of culture, degrees of sophistication, you know, just all around us everywhere. It can't matter as far as preaching the gospel goes. We are indebted to every person, both to the wise and the unwise. It doesn't matter if the guy's got a PhD in philosophy from Vanderbilt or, you know, he didn't graduate from the sixth grade. It doesn't matter if he uses impeccable English or he doesn't know how to speak English. It doesn't matter. We're indebted to everyone to share the gospel. That's how Paul felt about it. We need to feel that same thing. As much as in me is, I am ready to preach the gospel to you who are in Rome. I want to notice with you the connection in the original language, and this is something I've talked about before, and I know my little Greek spiels don't usually stick with y'all. I understand that, but that's why I have to repeat them every once in a while. But there are words, and I was talking about the word holy and sanctified and saint, how they're connected in the original language. Another group of words that's connected in the original language is the word gospel, evangelist, and sometimes preach, depending on what the original word is. But the gospel is the euangelion, the evangelion, if you will. Preaching the gospel, spreading the gospel, is euangelizo. You see it, they come right out of the same word. One's a verb, one's a noun. And then you have the evangelist. There's another noun that describes him, basically the same word. And if you, again, if you're seeing this in the original language, sometimes we see, you know, gospel, we see preach, we see evangelist. There's no word connection between those two. But in the original language, that's all connected together. That's all. You got the gospel that somebody is preaching, that somebody is gospelizing, and the person that is doing that is the gospelist, okay? What we call the preacher or evangelist. We are all, in that sense, evangelists. We are all gospelizers. We are all to be spreading the gospel. And so I understand there are some people that devote their lives to that, that have unique responsibilities, but to some degree it's true of all of us that we are those things. We are spreaders of the gospel. And so that brings us back where we started in verses 16 and 17. Paul is ready to preach the gospel everywhere to anybody. Because I am not ashamed, he says, of the gospel of Christ. He's not ashamed of it. Anything but. That's what he boasts in. It's the only thing he feels he can be proud of. You know, it's the only thing that gives meaning to his life as far as he's concerned. I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. It is the power of God to salvation. The dunamis, the extraordinary power. And yes, I know somebody took that word and made the word dynamite out of it in English. It doesn't really mean dynamite in the original language, but it is power and sometimes mighty power. So here is the power of God to salvation. Here's where it is. Just look at every one of those phrases. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. The good news, the glad tidings of Christ. It's the power of God to salvation. Here's what's going to save man. If anybody's ever saved, he's saved by the gospel. That's the power of God of salvation. Everyone who believes, you know, to that barbarian, to that Greek, to the wise, to the unwise, to the educated, uneducated, to the black man, the white man, the Mexican man, whoever. Everyone who believes. The Jew first and also to the Greek. That was the huge ethnic divide, of course, for Jews coming into Christianity. Maybe one of the largest divides of all time, but there are a lot of others. It doesn't matter. To the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it, that is in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. God is right, and he's right in what he did with humankind to bring us to a point of salvation through the gospel. God will be declared to be right in the way that he worked this out. And Paul will demonstrate that, especially in Romans chapter 3, the very righteousness of God. The righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. And that phrase has given lots of folks some bit of problem, I think, over the years. Let me just give you my take on it. I believe it's correct from the way those terms are used in Romans itself. You have Paul talking about obedience to the faith, right? So, in the gospel, there's revealed the righteousness of God from faith. That is the faith that God has revealed to us. What we're told in the gospel, what we're supposed to believe in. That's revealed to us. It's an objective thing, right? We contend earnestly for the faith. Jude 3. That objective thing then that I listen to and comes into me and I believe turns into my faith. It's from faith to faith. So the objective faith becomes a subjective faith. You see, here's what I believe. And what I believe corresponds with what God has given me to believe. From faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. Which faith? Your personal faith or God's objective faith? Both. There's one faith. There's one faith. All right. Next Sunday, we'll pick up there, follow your syllabus and see how far we'll get, do some reading and study outside of class, and please bring your thoughts and comments and questions with you when you come. Excited about this study. Hope you are as well.